This is a Suno India production, and you're listening to the Suno India Show.
This episode contains explicit content that may be inappropriate for children. Parental guidance is advised. Have you come across a video like this while scrolling on Instagram?
If this is a vulva and this is your vaginal opening, most people don't realize that the seat of all pleasure is actually up here in the clitoris.
Here's another one.
What is sex? Society will make us think that sex is penis and vagina penetration. However, sex really is far more expansive than that. Oral sex is sex, masturbation, anal sex, using your fingers, outer course, moving beyond just the genitals in your quest for sexual pleasure. There's so much out there.
The first one is from the handle Talk You Never Got, with almost 50,000 followers. The second one is from Lisa Mangaldas, who has over 8,30,000 followers. They are two among a growing number of what I'd like to call sex ed influencers online, using social media to impart sex education in India.
Hi everyone, I'm Karishma. I'm a sexuality educator. I run an Instagram page called Talk You Never Got, and I work in a consulting firm by day.
My name is Lisa Mangaldas, and I create pleasure-positive educational content around sexuality, sexual health, gender, and the body. I'm particularly interested in women and pleasure.
Because of pages like this, we now have sex education on our literal fingertips. And it comes not from the West, not from American TV shows, but from Indian women with our own local cultural experiences. Hi, this is Surya Tapa Mukherjee, your host for this episode of the Suno India Show. I spoke to Karishma and Lisa to find out what it means to be a sexuality educator online in India. So let's begin. Firstly, what is sex education?
When I say sex ed, what do I mean? Where everyone thinks sex ed means I'm going around telling people, here's how you have sex. I think I almost never ever tell people, here's how you have sex. It's usually more like, here's what sex means to different people. I want you to think about what sex means to you. And comprehensive sex ed has many different topics under it. So even when I'm talking to a group, even when I'm talking on Instagram, I'm talking about anatomy and physiology, yes. Talking about contraception and STIs. I think those are things people expect. But I'm also talking about identity, talking about gender identity and sexual orientation. I'm talking about consent. What does a healthy relationship look like? And I'm also talking about some of the cultural ripple effects of sex and how it's represented. So how sex is represented in the media, in music, in movies, and porn. Because porn is a big place that people are learning about sex.
There's so much information that we need that's practical and basic and like anatomical and, you know, stuff that should be general knowledge, stuff that you don't need to have even studied sexuality or be a doctor or anything for, stuff that just human beings deserve to know. We're kind of denied access to that information, right? Schools don't teach it. Families don't want to talk about it. I mean, so many people don't even know the parts of their own genitals. You know, there's people with vulvas who might discover that they don't menstruate from the same opening that they pee from, like after they're 30 years old, because they see a meme about it or something, you know, and that shouldn't be the case. I feel like you can't take the fun out of this, you know. Often sex education, especially when delivered in official contexts, if it is delivered at all, is focused only on the negative outcomes. And of course, it is important to prevent negative outcomes. Of course, we want to educate people about, you know, the potential risks that come with having sex, such as STIs or unintended pregnancy, or, you know, how we can prevent sexual violence. Of course, that's important, but that's not the only thing, right? We rarely ever hear about how can we ensure the ideal experience, right? How can we navigate pleasure? And I think that that's really important to me as well. Like, instead of it being so focused only on the negatives and scaring people so often, I mean, even in school curricula in countries where there is sex education, it's abstinence focused. And it's like, in a way, reiterating the fear and shame around sex, even while claiming to educate. You know what I mean? Whereas I feel like ideally you should just be informing people so that they can make better choices, safer choices, healthier choices, but informing them also of the joys of sex, right? I mean, of the positive aspects of it. So, and also talking about relationships and I mean, you know, going beyond just the absolute mandates, like the core, like the disclaimers around all the terrible things that could happen to you, you know.
When you were talking about like pleasure, you know, this reminded me of this scene from Bridgerton, where, you know, in the first season where the heroine, I don't remember her name, but she tells, you know, her husband that, oh, this is why our mothers don't teach us about sex and orgasms, because then we wouldn't get anything else done. Yeah, so like, so I really, you know, that's the thing. Like, it's like, I think the way we're taught about sex is so like fear centric, you know, it's about everything that can go wrong and not about like how, you know, you can just have like the best time, you know, just like by yourself, you know.
Right.
Yeah, just like wanting pleasure, wanting sex. And it's very gendered in a patriarchal context, like especially for people who are like any gender oppressed by the patriarchy, right? So largely cis women, but also anyone who's non-binary or gender non-conforming in any way. And so I feel like we, especially in the Indian context, like grow up with this notion or idea that cis men are the only people who want pleasure, who want sex, who will take the lead when it comes to these things. And anyone outside of that who wants this is wrong or immoral or any, you know, like there's just those types of ideas that exist. And part of them are culturally informed, sometimes it's religiously informed, sometimes we are told overtly, sometimes we are never told. Sometimes it is just the silence that's enough to tell people that this is something so wrong, we never discuss it and we never talk about it. It ends up literally impacting how much someone feels comfortable communicating with their partner. It impacts how someone feels about their own gender identity or sexual orientation. It impacts bodily, like how ready a body is for sex. I'm like, we have to talk about pleasure, because if we don't talk about pleasure, there's a lot of people out there who think it's normal and okay to not enjoy sex, and who think it's normal and okay to have sex which is causing them pain, discomfort, emotional discomfort, also in addition to physical discomfort, and that's just not okay.
And I want to know, like, in terms of, you know, talking about sex, right, like in India, this is not something that's like culturally, you know, that's very acceptable.
I started in 2017 on YouTube, because back then Instagram was less video centric. I definitely did think that, and especially like, as you were saying, even as recently as 5 years ago, there were almost no brown young people, let alone brownie women or queer people, like talking about this stuff publicly on the internet. Because I mean, you know, 5 years ago, homosexuality was still criminalized in our country, right? And most people, before you can even deal with trolls, like the stakes are so high, even in your own home, what are your parents going to say? What are your, you know, some people face very real consequences for expressing their own sexual agency or even just coming out or any of that. And so, I mean, I think it's not that people didn't want to do it or weren't doing it out of choice, but rather I think the environment, even the media environment, didn't feel safe for brown people to talk about sex publicly, right? I think some groundbreaking things, even though progress is always slow and there's a long way to go, I think the fact that 377 was repealed, the fact that the Me Too movement happened, some of this happened in 2018, I think, has catalyzed the realization, I think, that you know, in a more mainstream way, that this is important, that we need to talk about it, that not talking about this stuff has dire consequences, whether that's, you know, increased gender inequality, or whether that's not being able to speak up about experiences of sexual violence, or whether that's, you know, bogus things like conversion therapy still being practiced.
So I actually, when I started my page in 2020, I started to discover other pages and other people who were doing this work in very, like, some in small ways, some in big ways, some people were doing videos, some people were doing text, like a lot of different formats. And I kind of just, because of who I am as a person, just like made it my job to reach out to every person I came across and befriend them. Because I was like, there are, out of the entire country, there's maybe 20 people talking about this stuff on Instagram. And I don't understand why we need to do this alone or separately, and face the world alone type of thing. So like, we actually all, especially when Instagram was changing its censorship rules around end of 2020, we got, my friend and I got a group together where we said, let's literally just all hop on a Zoom call. So 10, 15 of us hopped on a Zoom call. And it was so powerful to just like show up and share what turned out to be really similar struggles and challenges. And I think, yes, the pandemic was a big push because suddenly people were making time to be online. In that sense, the pandemic shaped, I think, how people were communicating with each other, as well as also there was a whole new push for self-pleasure, which I don't think I saw before the pandemic as much. Like, people were not talking about it. These small businesses started during the pandemic where suddenly you had Indian companies producing sex toys, like, honestly revolutionary, where like all companies that I knew of before this were importing toys either from China or from known brands in the US, UK, all of that stuff. And suddenly there's startups doing that work in India. And I do think a large part of that is suddenly like people being like, wow, I literally can't step out of the house. What am I going to do to entertain myself? But also sometimes, you know, I'm not in a relationship, I'm not meeting my partner, or I'm stuck with my partner and I need to spice things up.
So how did Lisa and Karishma get into this work, and why are they so passionate about it?
So I actually studied English literature and visual art at Columbia University with a focus on gender and sexuality. And I was also an RA, for which we had to train incoming students about consent and contraception. So I've always had this interest in sexuality and in how it has been explored in art and in writing, and more from a sort of philosophical angle, I suppose, in my academic background. However, when I started creating this content, I realized that before I can even talk about like the philosophy of sexuality, there's so much information that we need that's practical and basic. When I started doing this work, I looked up curricula in sex education training programs across the world and tried to read all the books that are prescribed, because it's hard to, what do you do if you want to become a sex educator in India? Which college do you go to get that degree? Do you know what I mean? It isn't a sort of professional field yet here, which is considered even viable.
We have had sexual health educators in India, like Dr. Mahinder Vatsa, a gynecologist who became famous for his sex advice columns in magazines and newspapers since the 60s. However, social media has vastly changed what this work looks like and made it an option for people who are not gynecologists or psychiatrists.
My journey started when I was in college and teaching peer sex ed to high school students, when I was also myself a college student. And this was when I was in the US studying at Brown University. And so that experience really like shaped how I think about sexuality education, gave me some of my really initial
tools as well as training on how to do sex ed work, especially with younger people.
I also grew up listening to Lacey Green. Lacey Green was, I think, the main avenue for my learning a lot of sex ed stuff, because like any child out there, I used to Google everything. Everything. I would look up a dictionary and I would Google. And I remember coming across a lot of random stuff, like random words. I remember coming across the word orgasm in a Femina magazine or something and being like, what is this? Then I Googled it. Then I was like, I still don't understand. Arre, what is this pleasure thing they're talking about? You know, like there was like, I think they mentioned clitoris. And I'm like Googling what is clitoris. And it was in the context of oral sex. And I was like, what? People put mouths down there. Like, I was like mind blown. I just couldn't understand what is going on, right? And so I very much grew up as someone, as a curious child who would Google. And because I would Google and find things like a Lacey Green, and also, frankly, I don't know what all rubbish I also must have read, right? Like, I must have read the Yahoo Answers and the Quora and everything. And I was always that kid who knew a little bit more than my peers. And so I used to come and I used to say things and people would be like, you're so weird. Why do you know that? Or why are you talking about this, you know? I used to always get that reaction, especially in class 7, 8, because that's when I discovered Lacey Green. But I watched everything she put out. And then I really thought, like, okay, I've educated myself. I know everything I need to know. But then I got to college, and in my first semester, I was acting in the play. And the director of the play was another student. He was a second-year student. And he said, oh, you know, I do this thing where I go and I teach sex ed to high school students. And, you know, as a joke, the other people were like, oh, yeah, haha. Like, what do you tell them? You tell them you don't use oil-based lubes with latex condoms. And I'm like sitting there and thinking, what are they talking about? Like, I have no idea. What is lube? What is, like, there are non-latex condoms. What? Like, I was just so confused. And I remember thinking, oh my God, like talking about sex is taboo already, like talking about sex and teaching about sex, I could never. And this was like when I just gone to the US, just gone to college, like when I first month or two. But something about being in this like highly liberal space where people were very open, where people talked a lot about this stuff. And also college was just very, I think by virtue of being an American liberal university, like there were free condoms easily available around campus. People were talking about sex ed stuff more openly. There was just more of a culture of openness around sex. Also, I think it's the US or like depends where in the US, right? But also like where I was in the US. And so by the end of that first year in college, when I saw the application was open for this club, I was like, you know what? This is terrifying, but I think this is something I want to do, because I've learned so, like, I could feel how much I had grown within 1 year. And then I got, and I was like, I'm just going to apply. Let's see what happens. Worst case scenario, I don't get in. And then I got in. And I think that's really where my journey started.
Like, you must be getting like some sort of like negative, you know, reactions. And how is that in comparison with like the positive stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think, sorry, yes, you did ask me about that. I think maybe I didn't address that earlier. You know, I have found that overwhelmingly the response is positive, and I'm really glad for that. I think most people say thank you, Didi, or thank you, Lisa. This has really helped me. I found this information really useful. I figured something out. I mean, you know, overwhelmingly the types of DMs I get when people ask questions about sex or the body are like, am I normal? Is this normal? You know, like such and such thing happened to me. Is it normal? Whether it's to do with, I don't know, my private part skin is darker than the rest of my body. Is that normal? Or my labia are protruding. They're not tucked in like labias I see in porn. Is that normal? My one testicle hangs a little lower than the other. Is that normal? I have had a dream about someone of the same sex. Does that mean I'm a freak? You know, things like this, because we get so little scientifically accurate, judgment-free information that so often we pathologize our own very normal bodies or desires or curiosities. I masturbate every day. Is that, you know, am I going to go to hell? So I feel like at one level, people maybe just were so eager to have a place where they could ask these questions, because who do you ask, you know? And on the internet, what's much easier to find even than sex education is porn. Mainstream porn often has a lot of sort of, you know, very narrow body standards and fetishizes anything that is outside of the like porn star archetype. So that isn't the most reliable place to learn about sex. I mean, it's like learning about driving from watching like Formula One or something, you know? So I feel like overwhelmingly young people just seem like happy to have a trustworthy, judgment-free space. Of course, there's some pushback. I mean, I think most of what I say is just factual information. How can you debate with me when I'm telling you that the clitoris is a structure that extends internally? That is verifiable fact, you know? So I think that as opposed to, let's say, if you were talking about politics or talking about religion, where there's a lot of opinions and very polarizing opinions, when it comes to sharing factual information about sex and the body, what can you say to counter what I'm saying? You can call me a slut, right? And that's probably the most, of all the genre of pushback or hate that I get, I would say slut shaming is the largest one, because there's not much else people can do, right?
Like that just makes me like feel so good, like knowing that, you know, the people's like need to learn is greater than, you know, this enormous social stigma that exists, right? Like them wanting to actually access this information is greater than the need of like, oh, why is this person talking about these things online?
It's almost like the internet gives people this avenue where they can ask anonymously. They can make an account that is anonymous and send a message and ask. And so I think that's another reason why, you know, people are like, I have an opportunity to ask this question. I've not been able to ask anyone else. Let me ask this question here right now, you know? And I think a lot of times when I'm blocking people, it's also just boundary setting from my side. So they are coming with a genuine question, but I'm like, I've told you 5 times, I'm not a doctor. You need to go to a doctor with this question. Or like, no doctor. I even have started telling people, no doctor should be giving you a diagnosis on DMs. Like, please see an actual doctor, you know, who's like not going to ask you for pictures of your body on DMs. Like, if that stops happening, it's a red flag. So I think just like, a lot of times when I'm cutting people out, it's also like for that reason, for my also professional safety, where I'm like not going to give people things I'm not qualified to give.
Okay, so this is really interesting. So basically, like for a lot of people, it's easier to like ask you, you know, very personal medical questions than like actually seeing a doctor in person and having this conversation with the doctor, yeah, and hoping that the doctor is not going to judge them or like not feel that shame.
Yeah, I think so. A lot of people, yeah, there's a couple of things, yeah, there, right? So one is judgment from the doctor, where people are really, really afraid that the doctor will judge them. And I've had people come and tell me, my doctor told me never to masturbate again. And I was like, okay, let's unpack that. What did you go to the doctor for? And I'm,
wow, okay. Yeah,
right? Like why would anyone, any doctor say that? And so just like, and this was someone with a vulva. So it was just like, I think there's so much stigma anyway around people with vulvas experiencing pleasure. But yeah, it was wild. So I think there is that, like doctors can be judgmental, especially when they're older,
from a different generation, especially because medical textbooks are not updated. They have very moralistic and outdated terminology. So I think that's one aspect. But the other aspect is people often go to doctors with their parents and don't have an avenue to access doctors without someone going with them to the doctor. Especially I see this with young cis women when they're worried about something like pregnancy or STIs or anything like sexual health related. They're like, but how can I ask the doctor this question? Because I'm not going to be able to access a doctor without my family member coming with me. And so now there's like a bunch of online, thanks to the pandemic, online doctor consult type of options available. And so then I've been trying to channel people towards those as well. But yeah, I think it's a product of shame, sometimes also internalized, where people are just so shameful that they have any type of issue related to their sexual health, because sex itself is shameful, and then an issue related to sex is even more stigmatized. And like, it's just a very, very difficult conversation to have for most people.
And you've like, you know, gotten this network of people, and you know, you're constantly like doing this work and staying updated. But in terms of like, basically like financial, you know, sustainability, what does that look like? Because, you know, for like general influencers, obviously, like, you know, you hear that there's sponsorship and there's like ads and, you know, the collaboration with brands and stuff. So does that look similar for you, or what does that look like?
I'm not sure where to begin with this question. I feel like it could be a whole episode of a podcast. But I think it is important to recognize that it isn't the easiest profession to make a living from, especially starting out. So unfortunately, I mean, while I wish I could tell everybody, go and be a sex educator, I think, especially if you have financial responsibilities, it might need to start off as a part-time thing or a passion project, because the avenues to make this work sustainable are not as abundant as I wish they were. And at least in my experience, it took a while before it was sustainable. You know, I wanted this information to be free. You know, there are other ways one could have done stuff if it was subscription based or you're paying to watch for people to watch, but I really wanted for it to be free, accessible to anyone anywhere. And so YouTube seemed to be at the time the only place where I could do that. And I'm glad now most social media platforms are more and more video centric, and so, and podcasts, since we're on a podcast, are also becoming increasingly popular. So I more recently started a podcast. It's a Spotify exclusive and it's in Hindi. But yeah, basically I always wanted the information to be free, which meant that making it sustainable was going to take time, right? I didn't want to charge the audience to consume this content, because I really think young people who might not even have started earning yet deserve access to this information. So I worked as a TV presenter and writer alongside for the first few years. I did have an interest in journalism and some professional training as well. And I would try and write about similar themes and issues every opportunity I got for various publications. But I also did work that was unrelated, because, I mean, we all have to do all kinds of things to pay rent, right? So I've hosted lifestyle shows and sport and things like that. But that was never my end goal. I really did want to talk about, you know, the issues that I'm able to now on my digital platforms. I feel like it isn't fair to sugarcoat and be like, of course, you should quit your job and be a sex educator. I wish I could say that. But I would say that, especially if starting out, maybe keep your job and also create sex education content when you have the opportunity and time. And yet, I mean, there is obviously something really amazing about being able to do this thing that you love doing every single day and focusing all your energies on it. So I'm not saying let go of the dream at all. And I hope it happens. And I hope, and I'm actually quite confident that in time, there will be more and more like in my own 5 years, I think I'm getting so many more opportunities and seeing so much more interest in this content over the last 2 years or 3 years than it was back when I started, you know. So I'm sure 10 years or 20 years from now, maybe it'll be even more mainstream.
So So, you know, you have like these massive barriers in terms of like people just not getting sex in. You know, and we've done other stories, for example, we did one about like bullying of queer children and neurodivergent children. And there also it came up like, okay, sex ed is the solution, you know, to just educate people about queerness and, you know, queer kids around them and stuff. And then we also did an episode about HIV, where also it came up that sex ed is the solution to, you know, help and educate like young people who contract HIV. So sex ed keeps coming up and like as a solution for a number of different things. And yet in schools, that's not really happening. We don't know when it might happen in like a proper way. So how are you sort of navigating this larger, you know, institutional challenges like all over the country? And what are your sort of goals in terms of like how do you see the future in these sort of ways?
I'm going to start with what you're saying about like sex ed being a solution to many different things. I think that's true. But I think it's also true only when it's good sex ed, when it is comprehensive sex ed, when it is sex ed that is coming from a rights-based approach, that is queer-centric, that is, you know, pleasure positive, not acting like pleasure doesn't exist for people, that centers the agency of young people. And I think that the things that I'm naming right now are giant mindset shifts. They're not... It's not like I'll give you a textbook or a curriculum and a teacher is able to just go implement it. I was reading this book, The Right to Sex by Amiya Srinivasan, and she pointed out, like, we don't need just to give sex ed teacher training to teachers. We need, like, an entire feminist, like, revolution happening with teachers. It needs to be more towards the effects of, like, fully unlearning all the patriarchal concepts you've grown up with and then growing up and then like relearning everything that's accurate. Now that's really great in theory, but the average teacher is underpaid and overworked. And so putting this onus on educators alone is massive. You can't possibly expect that. And like anecdotally, I can tell you one experience where I worked very closely with a school in Calcutta, and we came up with a curriculum and the school hired a school counselor, and they were going to go and, you know, they were like, we are marking out one period in the week where every class gets this conversation. The school counselor can't take all the classes, so other teachers will take some classes, and then the counselor will check in. And, you know, we like worked on this whole system. 6 months later, I checked back in with the students, and the students, when the teachers are not there, said, we have not had one such conversation. The teachers are too awkward to talk about it. We didn't even know that's what this period was for. And so I think that's, we're like asking a 40, 50-year-old person to change everything they've ever been taught and believe in, based on what? On like a Vana, okay, like teachers meeting, we're going to talk about this taboo topic. It's not going to happen. It's really tough. And so I feel like when it comes to institutionalizing, I'm still figuring out what is the best way to do this. There are many different models that seem to have worked in many different parts of the world. So I think one model is by using educators who exist in the school, who are part of the school system. One model is very much these one-off workshops, which is kind of what I also end up doing because schools think that is the intervention that's needed. I kind of disagree because it's like you come, you talk once and you leave, but the questions that people face through their growing up, like there can be a different question someone has in class 7 and a different question someone has in class 9. And they should have an avenue to ask that every step of the way and have those different evolving conversations. And so I don't know if one-off workshops is the answer, but it's better than nothing, right? So I think that's what I've been doing a lot with educational institutions, with student groups that do this. The other model is also peer education, where we're like, okay, young people are not going to hear about this or not going to listen to older, like when there's a huge generation gap, there's like moral differences that come up, there's a lot of like misunderstandings and fear of judgment and all of that stuff. And so the peer education model is what I was doing in college and while teaching high school students also. So that's another thing that was just like, could be one answer. And then I think, of course, there's also just the
view that you should target all stakeholders in a young person's life. So just doing the school way is not enough. Maybe you need to be targeting the parents as well, and thinking about how you can bring parents along the journey of having and creating better spaces in the home. Of course, all this is just very, very idealistic. And I think the grassroots work that's going on, there are people doing this in every model possible. There are like small, small pockets of people doing this at a grassroots level, following a few different ways.
I mean, I really do hope more schools introduce CSE. I think that would be fantastic and necessary. I was very excited that last year, a school in Bombay, JB Pettit, it's a girls' school, because it was during the pandemic, school was online. Unfortunately, I couldn't actually deliver it offline with the kids, but their whole school was online, right? So as part of their school hours, like this was not some optional on the side, if you want, online workshop, but rather within school hours as part of the thing for their 9th and 10th grade students, they had a session with me. And I was really happy that schools, well, at least this school was really sex positive and no holds barred in, you know, allowing me to conduct that session exactly the way I wanted to plan it. It was very open, honest, judgment-free. I mean, I focused on stuff like anatomy, you know, talked about a whole bunch of things. I mean, it was like an hour and a half long session with each class. And there were so many questions. And even though the class teacher and I think their biology teacher, one of their science teachers, was also present in the online thing, the students were so open and asked so many questions. And I was really, I mean, it seemed like they felt respected and safe with their teachers. And like this was very much in keeping with the general environment in their school. And I was really excited about that because I think, I mean, you know, I'm 31 years, I'm going to be 32 next week. So when was I in school? Like 20 years ago, you know? And I think there's been change. I mean, I see, I obviously always there's so far to go, right? When you say there's been change, it doesn't mean our work is done. However, today, 12-year-olds know about pronouns, you know? They know more about menstruation than I did at that age. They know more about many things, actually, than we did. And I think that is encouraging, I think, because, you know, I think that is an indication that things are slowly, I mean, again, I feel like you can never make any statement anymore on the internet without giving 50 caveats. But I think you understand what I'm getting at, right? I mean, I think more young people today are aware of the idea that gender is binary is a very limiting idea, that the idea that sexual orientation is only heteronormative is also limiting. I mean, I think, you know, when I was 12, nobody was having these conversations in my peer group. And today I see young people, if that classroom was evidence of that, so many of these people in their late teens were questioning these ideas and were aware of certain terms. I mean, even just the terminology around discussing gender or the body or whatever, I feel most of us didn't have the vocabulary, and now many more people know about it. And I think, I mean, you know, growing up, our pop culture reference points were all so heteronormative and so often even misogynistic and regressive. And I mean, to a large extent, there still is a lot of that. But I think like a show like Sex Education on Netflix, or a show like even Made in Heaven, closer to home, that like questions all the, you know, sort of glorification of marriage that is so frequent in our cultural context. I think it's I'm glad these exist now, you know. We didn't have shows like that growing up. So, I mean, change is rarely radical. It tends to be incremental. But, you know, if I was in school 20 years ago, I think 20 years is quite a long time. And I think there has been some change in certain, at least in certain places, since then.
What are some of these, you know, reactions of gratitude? Like, can you share some stories of like how, you know, your work has impacted people and sort of, I'm sure like it has had like quite a big influence in some people's lives, you know, because when you don't get this information, even just getting it can really impact your life. So can you share like some stories that you've heard from people?
Sure. I mean, I think for me, the message or reaction that just makes my heart dance, and I've received it many times, is when women reach out to me being like, I had my first orgasm thanks to something I learned in your videos, or, you know, your video about how central clitoral stimulation is to orgasm for most vulva owners really like just opened my mind to how I was seeing sex in this penetration-centric way, and I realized how my pleasure works now, and I had my first pleasurable sexual experience because of something I learned from your content, you know, or like I've become more communicative with my partner, and now the sex we're having is more inclusive of my wants thanks to the stuff I've learned from watching your content. Once I was at the airport and this woman comes up to me and she's like, are you Lisa? So I was like, hey, yes, hi. And she was like, you know, I just want to tell you, I've had my first vibrator thanks to something I saw on your page. And I have had the best time ever. It was like Aladdin ka chirag. I can't thank you enough. I would never have done it. I thought sex toys were so silly and frivolous and for some, you know, laughs and for a bachelorette party or something. I didn't realize there could be a tool of discovery around your pleasure and of like wellness even, because I really am reaping the benefits of exploring my pleasure now. And, you know, so it was really lovely to have that type of interaction on more than one occasion. And I'm just glad. I'm glad people are feeling less ashamed, more empowered.
So one example is this person who said that their doctor said never masturbate again. It was one of those random DM conversations, right? Like part of a day's work for me. The person said, oh, this is what my doctor said. My doctor said never masturbate again. I had this infection. And the person said, you know, like as someone with a vagina, you should just not masturbate, blah, blah, blah. Okay. And I remember like telling them like, listen, maybe the doctor is saying because of your infection, follow the protocol. And here's some ways to masturbate a little bit like more safely potentially. But masturbation in itself doesn't cause infections, right? Like I gave them this little bit of information. Forgot about the conversation. Months later, I was in a clubhouse room and someone comes on and goes like, oh my God, like you saved my life that day. I was so stressed out. I came home from the doctor. I was in such a bad mood. I mean, I was feeling so upset. I was feeling so anxious, blah, blah, blah. And this person went on such an emotional journey and hearing like just a couple of texts being like, hey, this was really helpful. Or like, it's okay to want to masturbate and it's okay to masturbate. Like really, really helped this person and like help this person feel affirmed, seen, not shameful. And so that was really, really fun to like have this random conversation many months later in a clubhouse room. The other example, which feels the most tangible to me also is like, so one of my good friends lives in Singapore and his sister, like they are both Indian origin, like their parents are Indian, but they've lived their entire lives in Singapore. And he said his sister had never seen a brown person talk about sex, never seen an Indian person talk about sex, and didn't think that desire or like pleasure or sexuality or like wanting any of those things was an option for them in a way. And then they said that literally like seeing my videos over time made it feel okay for them to have like some sort of mini sexual awakening and explore desire and sexuality and stuff. And that to me was just so powerful and just like, yeah, this feels very strange to say as like patting my own back or tooting my own horn, but this just felt really revolutionary.
Great. Those were all of my questions. Anything that you want to add?
This was really fun. I thank you for asking me all those questions. They really made me think.
I always like to end by saying that I hope that anyone listening will join me in imagining a world where all sexual experiences are consensual, safe, and pleasurable. Thank you.
Please rate our podcast and leave a comment if you like it. Underreported and underrepresented stories can become mainstream only if it reaches more people. So please support us by visiting a contributing page on our website, sunoindia.in, or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.